May it please the Court.
You may proceed.
I'd like to start with the issue that, in my view, is the most likely to determine the outcome. That issue relates to the most serious charges, the trust accounting, a year's worth of trust accounting violations, and then why we oppose probation. The violations may sound familiar. In a year's review, we found 8 large round number deposits from the attorney's operating account into his trust account. And we found over 20 trust account checks going to the operating account without any documentation as to why. Again, some round numbers. We had advance fees and filing fees both going into the operating account. At least 7 or so situations where client funds intended to be held in trust were depleted while they were held in there. In other words, like a sub-account overdraft. For that particular client, the money was gone while it was to be held for that client and spent elsewhere.
What I saw in this case was the assertion that a lack of cooperation or with respect to the investigation. Is that correct?
That's where I've said it. Is that those are the underlying facts. They're similar to some other cases. In addition to almost a complete lack of records, no settlement sheets, client ledgers, billing records, supporting documentation, none of those were provided or available. So with that, like I say, some of these things sound familiar to the court and where we've agreed to probation. And the difference here is what you're talking about, I think, Judge Teitelman. Rule 5.225, the probation rule, sets some minimum standards for probation. And one of them is that probation is permitted only if the court decides that the attorney can be adequately supervised. A corollary of that is, why is that rule in place? What can we do as the probation system of court to when lawyers, it just appears to be intended to address law practice management skills and things like that. It doesn't appear to be addressed, and especially for lawyers who admit their failings and want our help. It seems evident that this attorney doesn't want to have anything to do with us. And we, frankly, have little confidence in our ability to supervise him in a way that would protect the public. Now, if the court tells us to do that, we'll do our best. But
are you saying this is continuing, continuing not wanting to work with you and continuing to show lack of remorse, or is that was just his feelings early on?
It's throughout. I mean, I can't say it got better. It really didn't. There were a couple of things. I mean, we got some records, but we insisted and insisted and insisted before we ever got them.
Opposing counsel says it's not that he refused to produce records, it's that his record keeping was so bad that he just didn't have the records, and you all assumed he had to have ones that he didn't produce, but in fact it was that there weren't records, so he couldn't respond to your request for information.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's some
that's not lack of cooperation if he said that. But you're saying there was lack of cooperation, so
sure. There were multiple times where we asked for things, and he said, "I'll get back to you," or "Can I have more time?" That's not the same as saying, "I'm doing the best I can."
Then did he ultimately, or within the time he said, say, "I just don't have those," or did you just find that out because nothing got produced, or tell me how?
For all of these counts, nothing was done in the time where we initially said we need the records. So there was always at least one or two requests for extension that we granted. And then there would be a time where he would say, "Well, I'll do it by a certain date." And we still wouldn't get it. And that's across the board on these violations, except maybe count 3, I think.
And the extended time that you granted him, he did not say, "Look, I just don't have those records."
Now, there were times when he said, "I don't have the records. I don't keep settlement sheets," for instance. Uh-huh. But there were,
and that in itself is a violation, but I'm not sure that's a failure to cooperate. It's a failure to keep required records, and that's what I'm just trying. But the failure to cooperate is what most bothers you, so I'm trying to separate those out.
Okay. I mean, here's his response to our request for trust accounting records. First was, this was a bank coding error, which is what the bank initially said, so you shouldn't check. Trust me. And he claimed selective harassment of us, by us, to seek his trust accounting records, even though the explanation he gave for why the overdraft occurred, that is, was that he used, his staff had written a check from the trust account to pay a garnishment of a client, which is, makes sense to all of us, that's where it should have come from, but it overdrew because he thought it should have come out of the operating account. I mean, we had to investigate at that point. And it hardly seems like selective harassment. And had we, you know, trusted him because he had the top secret clearance years ago, then we wouldn't know what the mess is that this trust account is in. And yes, he did fail to provide records of communication with his clients when that was the issue in the case. You know, show us that you talked to your clients about this. You know, you've told us my client didn't take my calls. Okay, show me the records where you tried to call. Those aren't provided. I mean, that's what we have over and over in this case. But it's not just that. There's also the misdirection problems. I mean, the red herrings that are thrown out there. My response was complicated by a fire at my office. But then when you ask him, you know, what records would have been produced that were lost in the fire, well, nothing that would have responded to this case. The answer to
Did he basically, also I'm reading what you're saying, he tried to hide the fact that he didn't have records of communications or a trust account or other things by saying, I'll get to you and I'll look for them and so forth. But Or would he have thought he had them and had lost them? Or
I'd be speculating. I don't know.
How were clients, if any, financially harmed by his actions?
That's really hard to tell. The records are so bad that it's hard to tell. I will acknowledge, I mean, there's no client complaints here about money. The client complaints we have here are about other things, you know, conflicts and communication and those good sorts of things. You know, the one client, count two, is about money, but it's not necessarily, you know, on its face, she didn't know where the money had gone, and the complaint was that he had stolen anything or that sort of thing. It was, she was asking, seeking a refund from what she thought was an excessive payment. So because of those things, we don't think, as I started with, we don't think supervision, that probation is intended to address these types of problems. I mean, we just, as I said, you know, if the court wants to do that, then the first thing we ask is an opportunity to suggest some conditions like we do in a lot of probation cases.
In a lot of cases, by the time the case gets here, there's information in the record that the attorney has taken classes in law practice management, has hired an accountant to set up a new system and so forth. What does the record show here? Are there a better record-keeping system in place now?
The record doesn't support that. Okay. But what's before the court doesn't support either way.
Okay. The record doesn't support if he's still using the same practices he used to use or
right.
Or a different ones. Okay.
Right. So we think that actual probation with no, I'm sorry, actual suspension with no probation is appropriate. At least 6 month suspension is appropriate.
What do you think his state of mind was, mens rea, in doing all this?
Here's what it seems to be. It seems to be that his view was possession is 9/10 of the law. If money is in one of my accounts, I can use it however I want. I don't have to keep records about it. I can transfer it back and forth at my leisure when I need it. I'll take care of the clients, but following the rules isn't part of, following 115 is not part of my process. So is there an intent to steal? We don't have any evidence of that. And again, there's no client complaints about that. But there are troublesome issues when the repeated checks go from his trust account while there's client money in there to his operating account.
How many accounts do we have here? Three?
I think four. Two, three, actually five. Two, three, four, five, and seven.
And so,
are the count numbers.
Of those, are you alleging misappropriation of money?
Yes, just in count seven.
And that is?
That's the trust accounting. That's the year's worth of trust accounting records.
Now, what about the other accounts, conflict of interest? Is the accounts are not dealing with the trust account.
Right. The key one there, and perhaps the most interesting one, is count three, where the attorney took on a criminal defendant who had already pled guilty, agreed to help set aside the plea, got paid for that, and agreed to try to represent him for a $30,000 fee.
How much?
$30,000. But it's a serious felony assault, burglary, two, so serious charges. And to secure a fee, because neither the client nor his family really had that cash, he prepared a deed of trust, a promissory note, and eventually a quitclaim deed to himself to transfer the client's mother's house to him. He did that without informed consent, without notice to the client or his mother that they get independent legal advice.
And now he says that if he had done that to the client, that would have been a violation, but that his mother is not his client, and whatever may be better practice, it wasn't a violation of any rules because he didn't have to tell her anything. She wasn't his client, and it wasn't his client's money that was being taken. And you're saying, well, he knew the client lived in the house, but is there any case that can you give us help in anything in the guidelines or other cases interpreting the guidelines or the sanctions rules that indicate that family members need to be informed, or that if you live in a residence and that gives you that kind of interest where you have to give
right money. No, the short answer is I don't have any cases to support the theory. I think the policy arguments contained in the comment to the rule help explain it. 1.8 is the rule. 1.88 comment 1 talks about the lawyer's skills and training and the relationship of trust. Those things are put the lawyer and the client at risk of overreaching in these types of cases. It's hard to figure out how it's any less risk of overreaching when a parent's paying for a child's representation for a criminal case.
Of course, there's lots of situations where families do provide the money for criminal representation.
And fees are arm's length transactions, whether they're with the client or with the family. You know, that's not covered by 1.8. I mean, it's specifically excluded in 1.8. But that's not what we have here. We have the security agreement and eventually the taking of the house.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. She'll have time on rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Let me proceed.
Well, first I'd like to address the issue that there's an allegation of misappropriation, and there is not. There's nothing in the information. There's nothing in the informant's brief that suggests that there's any misappropriation.
I made a distinction between misappropriation and stealing.
Well, if we're willing to make that distinction, then, I mean, certainly we're suggesting that there's sloppy record keeping. We acknowledge that all along. There was never any attempt to disguise the fact that his records, or the lack thereof, was a reality.
Well, using your client's money as your own, whether or not you intended to steal it, isn't that misappropriation?
Well,
not stealing, but
again, that's the assumption that's reached on the basis of the research that is done by the OCDC.
So, can you avoid it?
But he didn't admit, no. Again, there's no evidence to suggest that he used client's funds as his own. If you look at the briefs, his original view of these matters, and by the way, this has all changed as a result of these proceedings, but his original view of the matter was that he wrote contracts that enabled him to take the fees that were paid to him as earned upon receipt. That's wrong. That is another matter that is addressed, or at least in the earlier proceedings before the panel, which he testified to as recognizing that that's incorrect.
Okay, that's not the only thing, is it? Say that was okay. Say he'd been correct that was okay.
Well, we're not saying
that's
okay.
I understand that, absolutely. But say, accept your explanation that he thought that was okay and that's why he did some of the things he did. Does that get rid of all the allegations here, or are there still additional problems
of depositing things in different accounts?
It gets rid of
the bulk of the allegations. If you look at the allegations, there were originally 7 counts, 2 were dismissed. Count 2 involves a fee dispute in reality and a claim of lack of communication or failure to communicate. If you look at the failure to communicate claim in that count 2, it involves a woman who objected on at the earliest it could have been would have been November 25th, and by December 8th, she had new counsel who contacted my client. So she's looking at a one-week period where she claims he didn't personally speak to her. But the testimony at the panel and the transcript will show that she acknowledged having spoken to him. She acknowledged speaking to his staff. She just wasn't happy speaking to his staff about the matter of a $200 fee that was billed to her erroneously. Now, even the informant acknowledges that that was probably just a mistaken billing that went out. But you've just heard him characterize this as a lengthy process of changing explanations that are internally inconsistent or contradictory, and he's using that to suggest that this is an attempt for him to avoid responsibility or to not accept the authority of the Office of the Chief Disciplinary
Counsel.
Well, why
isn't it that?
Well, it isn't, because at the point where he originally answered the question, remember this is only after an information is filed, his original understanding was that those were fees. They were just fees that were paid.
No, but the question is cooperating. There's lots of investigation that goes on prior to an information.
And he cooperated.
Well, but the OCDC says he did not, that they had to keep asking. He said, you don't have any right to ask this. This is inappropriate.
Well, he didn't
keep saying
that.
You should take my word for it.
He didn't keep saying that. There's one letter where he inarticulately and unwisely responded to what he considered to be the inappropriate pursuing of the trust account check that bounced. That didn't actually bounce. When he produced the document, which is their exhibit 88, I believe, that's from the bank stating it didn't bounce, it was a bank error, a coding error, they're now suggesting that, well, he's lying about that, he has no good faith basis upon which asserting that claim. Well, he did assert that claim. He had a good faith basis upon which to believe that. But they continued with wanting more documents on the trust account and that sort of thing, and he reacted to that. Certainly this can't be the first time that an attorney has been less than thrilled at the prospect of dealing with these kinds of claims.
Well, was that a single instance, and then
yes.
He realized he was required to cooperate and did thereafter?
He realized that when he finally got around to obtaining counsel, present counsel, who explained to him that the process, which by the way is unfamiliar to him, and to many people by the way on this new bouncing a trust account check, that he just had a common sense view that if the check wasn't bounced, you could produce it.
Well, what about
that it didn't
bounce? Repeated promises to provide information and provide documents, and then he failed to do so within the time order,
well,
explained that he didn't have them?
Informant answered that. He did provide them. He requested extensions, and extensions were granted. He did comply with most of the extensions, some of them not. But there were explanations for some of these records not being produced.
I'm a little bit worried that an answer to not being sanctioned for misusing money is that you just lose all the records and then you can't prove it. I mean, that's an effect here. How do we know what's going on now?
Well, normally you'll have someone claiming that their money has disappeared. Normally you'll have a complaint.
So in the absence of a client complaint of stealing?
But given the volume of inconsistencies in his record keeping, certainly you would have that. I mean, what kind of case would you expect there to be someone coming in saying he stole my money or he misapplied it? We're talking about large checks that are deposited in the wrong accounts or denominated upon deposit in the wrong way.
And all of these are only advance checks. If we got rid of that rule about advance payments not being your own, he would have had 100% compliance with the trust account rules?
I believe that would probably be in 90% of the cases would be. There's so many of them, I can't assert to you that there isn't some other example of something.
Well, but in this case, there actually were agreements with the clients that the money was not his.
Well, there were agreements with the clients that the money wasn't the client's also.
Well, but it was that this was a payment, and the payment would be earned at a set rate per hour.
Well, actually, all the client contracts involved in this case indicated payment was earned upon receipt. And that permeates all of the practices that underlie this matter before you. Now, that's a practice that does not continue to exist. Now,
if he was put on probation, would he follow the guidance of the OCDC?
Oh, certainly he would. But, Your Honor, he's already complied with those requirements in the process of going through this. And he so testified at the panel hearing.
And
there's
so
no evidence before you that these practices continue to exist.
Well, what evidence is there of what his current practices are?
the testimony at the panel, and the fact that those records are available to anybody who wants to see them, and the panel or the investigators had never requested it.
Did he testify that he now has an accountant, that he keeps records?
Yes.
Tell me what he does do, not what he doesn't do.
Yes, he now separates the account. One of the problems was he was a very large expanding operation that got out of hand, and there were many trust accounts, and so attorneys that were working for him were writing out of different trust accounts. And so there was a complexity there. He has since closed the numerous offices that he had. He has centralized his operation here in the Jefferson City office. He has purchased a very expensive program or something that's supposed to be designed for lawyers not to put them in this kind of bind, largely because of his concerns about the bouncing of a check in the trust account, which triggers this sort of thing.
What type of practice does he have?
It's diverse. He's in reality he's a sole practitioner, but he's employed many people over the years for short periods of time. There's always been a pretty massive turnover, and that's another part of the problem. I wouldn't offer it as a mitigating circumstance, but it is in the nature of the chaos that was going on.
Does he have an accountant now?
He does have an accountant. He has, but he's an accountant for other things too. So he's now employed the accountant for the purpose of doing some, I don't know what the phrase is for that, but you know, troubleshooting his trust account stuff. But he no longer has a problem with the trust account. He no longer deposits fees as being earned upon payment. He deposits everything in the trust account. He writes out of the trust account when the dispersals are appropriate. Now, at the panel hearing, he was willing to answer these questions and explain any of these individuals, but was never asked. That was not something that was asked. And it was a very lengthy hearing that we had. The question about his failure to cooperate with the OCDC's request. He provided every document. There's not one document that they can point to that exists or that they even speculate exists that he hasn't provided. He provided what he had. The problem was what he had was woefully inadequate to the questions being asked him.
Well, why didn't he just tell him that instead of keep saying, you said I'm going to produce it, I don't have it.
There were other documents that were sought, and we did produce them. One of the issues was this thing about the fire of his office that burned down in Columbia.
Which was long after the original request.
Well, yeah, but all of his computer records were found in there, and what he hoped to find were records pertaining to some of these other matters that had been requested, and or actually, I should say, I hoped to find them. And we ended up going through old hard drives, and all, it took quite a bit of time, but it took longer than I thought. Some of the delays are occasioned by me, because I got into this and it was much bigger problem than I had originally envisioned given the various issues that were going on. Now, the complaints of the seven counts are the seven counts. If you take away the conflict, which I think you addressed, it wasn't a client. I don't think that there's anything really to argue about that.
The son lived with the mother.
I didn't live with the mother. That's not true.
What?
That's untrue. The son didn't live with the mother. The son was incarcerated prior to the time that he became the attorney for the son. The son has never been out of prison for that purpose.
There's a relationship between the mother and the son, is there not?
There is, and the son testified at the panel hearing, and he testified that he had no objections or no problems with the representation of Mr. Trapp as regards him as the client. And in fact, he made the same thing on oath when he took his plea bargain, which he was eminently pleased with, that he got on his criminal matters. Because one of the colloquies that the court goes through is there anything your attorney did or didn't do that you object to? And there was a lengthy colloquy at that hearing, and he stated at that point. When he came to the panel hearing, he didn't complain either. So the client had no complaint.
So why did the mother give her house over to him?
The mother actually was the person who pushed to have that done because they wanted Mr. Trapp to represent him. They wanted him to do this. And it was not a bad choice. He got for this man, the defendant, a considerably improved outcome over what was facing him in Camden County, I think, among other counties. They gave over the house in order to be a security for the payment of those fees over time, which she did. She's made those payments. The house got signed back over to the mother. She went and got another attorney to hold the lien on the house in escrow. which was how you do those things. And so that's all been resolved, and she made those payments. It's all been paid up.
You've heard Mr. Phillips. He said these kind of allegations, often OCDC will recommend probation. They're not here because they have simply no faith that your client will cooperate or follow the rules with probation. Tell me why you think that they should have that faith.
Well, I don't know why they would suggest they don't have faith in him doing that, because the suggestion that he has been defiant, the suggestion that he has been refusing in his efforts is incorrect. It is incorrect on the face of the transcripts before you.
Tell me why. I mean, I think you may be reinforcing their concern. If they feel what he's done is not cooperative compared to what attorneys normally do, and you're telling me he's going to continue behaving in that way, that's not going to give them much confidence.
That's not what I said. I'm not saying he's going to continue in that way. What I'm suggesting is the premise of your question is
I'm saying the premise of their recommendation is that he has not, and he may not in the future. Can you tell me why they should feel he will cooperate?
Because he hasn't refused to cooperate previously. The fact that they believe it is the issue here. And what I'm suggesting is that that is demonstrably not the case. There is not a document that he failed to produce. He didn't do it timely. And if you look at the rule, it doesn't say anything about prompt. It says failure to cooperate.
And so going forward...
failure to produce, actually.
Going forward, if they ask for documents, if they ask for...
Whatever he
quarterly
asked,
reports, copies of...
Whatever he has, they'll get, which is what they got before. They didn't get what they got as quickly as they wanted it before, and that's been bootstrapped into an argument that he's defiant and he's refusing. The transcript, even by the investigator for the OCDC on the trust account deal, acknowledged they did not ask for clarifications on any of those matters,
reason,
and they did not fail to get the documents that were in existence.
Is there a reason to think that there'd be delays, similar delays in the future, or is this set up such now that he does have the records and can produce them within a reasonable
There's no reason to
time.
Believe there would be delays in the future, barring the unforeseen events that may happen, as happened in this case. His attorney, for example, occasioning a delay because he came down with 10 days of whatever I think they called flu, and I was missed a deadline there. But I, in every occasion, contacted OCDC or Mr. Phillips or Kelly Dillon and informed them of these delays. Now, they weren't happy, but these are not refusals. And the case law in previous matters where you've dealt with this, these are nothing like the case before you here. These are cases, the earlier cases, where the attorney just absolutely blows off OCDC, doesn't go to the panel, doesn't respond to the letters, doesn't acknowledge anything, doesn't even show up to the hearings before the Supreme Court. Those are cases where you've gone and put people on suspension.
Is an objective test of blowing off?
Well,
they have been blown off? Is that the...
I think it is objective in the sense that it's an inarticulate phrase, but I can't think of a better phrase for it. When you're told by the panel that we're going to have a panel and you're supposed to be here on December whatever, and you don't show up, as in the case of a couple of cases that we cite in our brief, that's a whole different order of fish.
Counsel, you're out of time, but do you want to make a closing statement about what type of punishment, if any, your client should be imposed?
I appreciate that.
No, go ahead. I'm asking you to say that.
Well, yeah, we believe that under the ADA standards, the guidelines, that these are cases which are not knowingly intentional violations of the rule. Even in the event that you find there's a conflict issue under that third count, clearly, the rule doesn't alert an attorney to that kind of conflict. It says a client. So we would believe that the most serious matter, and we agree with the informant, is the record-keeping aspect in the trust account. I glean from your questions that the refusal to cooperate is a significant matter for the court. We vehemently object to the characterization that this is a refusal to cooperate. It is that the documents sought didn't exist. Therefore, we think that the standard to be employed in this case is more along the lines of a written reprimand. He has no prior criminal history. He has no prior disciplinary matters before this court. Many cases that have gone to this court before take that into considerable consideration when they determine what the sanction is. The fact that he hasn't previously been placed on probation, I think, suggests that certainly that's worth a try. If you were to place him on probation, and we're not arguing for probation, I think the reprimand is the appropriate thing to do, because there's no harm to clients, there's no intent to false motives or anything like that. He didn't do it in an act of self-serving and that sort of thing. So that I think that the reprimand is the way to go. But were you to put him on probation, clearly, probation is something that he's capable of doing and certainly willing to do, but willing in the quotation of would rather not, but then nobody really wants to do probation. So what I'm suggesting to you is it's unnecessary to protect the public from this practitioner who's been doing this a long time. And that
how is... How long has he had bad record keeping and all the rest of the dollars today? How long was that?
When he went out on his own, he was with another firm before, and all that was done with the other firm that he was in. Now, when he went out on his own, he was his own operator.
But so how many years was that?
Six years to date.
So it wouldn't be unreasonable for the OCDC to think, well, we need to make sure that this is being carried forward, would it not be?
Well, the OCDC could have made sure that that had been done. We asserted to them it was done. They made no effort to ascertain whether or not his trust account practices had changed. And the major matter here before you is the trust account. We believe that that is a significant matter. But it's a significant matter that has, in fact, been resolved and could have easily been ascertained. Were there an interest in ascertaining?
Well, is it the burden of the OCD? When it was found it's been a problem, wouldn't you think that would be a sign of good faith to say, well, here's how we improve things?
I mean, we did that.
You have to wait for the OCDC to inquire?
Your Honor, again, as I refer you to the transcript of the panel hearing, that was was asserted and stated, and it was uncontroverted at the panel. That was assumed to be true. They have no reason to believe it isn't true. He's not asserting that their things haven't substantially changed. I believe they think he probably has changed. They're not getting...
But you said you put in the record that he had changed on what he was doing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that is in the record. It was before the panel?
It's the transcript of the panel, which was submitted as part of their submission, which we use theirs.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips, are all the record keeping... the vast majority of the record keeping problems dealing with the use and deposit of advance fees?
No.
But what else is involved?
Filing fees. Well, if it were just advance fees, then there wouldn't have been all that money in there that he wrote checks for from the trust account back to his operating account. Because he told us that his theory was everything that got his advance fees was put in his operating account directly. So there's no reason for these large amounts of trust funds
but
to go
out to
operating.
But you don't know they were misused. You just can't figure out why they were made.
Well, personal injury. There's other types of cases than just his advance fees.
But I'm asking those, if I recall correctly from the briefing, your concern is that there's no explanation for why those transfers were made and there's no records to show it. Not that you know they were misused, but that because of the records you're unable to determine.
Well, that was probably an understatement. Because we know that money went out of the trust account without any explanation. He says, he's told us, it wasn't advance fees because I was putting my advance fees into my operating account. So it was client money. And it got spent, and we know some of it got spent. You really have to look at the audit.
Going forward, are you assured that he's now in compliance?
And no. Are we sure he's now in compliance? Definitely not.
He said he now has records and audits. And so, I mean, tell me why you don't think your oversight, because, of course, if he doesn't do what he's required, then it's a violation of his probation, and then a sanction would be imposed if this court imposed a sanction with probation. Tell me why that's not adequate here. You obviously don't feel it is, and I want you to explain further.
Well, I asked the court, again, to look at the record on the audit and see if that's what the evidence shows, what the respondent said it was, and also to look at the record on the responses and see if that shows what he just what was just said, because it's not.
What did DHP find?
DHP found violations of the trust accounting violations, found violations of everything except count three, the conflict issue.
What did they find on cooperation? Or was that an issue?
Well, it is an issue. It is charged in counts four and five.
Okay.
the counts that are really nothing else except cooperation.
Right.
But it's found.
And they found those.
They did, yes. But we're way beyond the record.
The information you need as far as having the accountant, has he given you, in good faith, told you he's got an accountant, he's got, give me the name of the accountant, what's going on, allowed you to audit his accounts with the accountant, has all that happened or not?
Yeah, here's the problem. I don't know how to say it. We're way beyond the record. I'm not sure how much you want me to answer on what I know has happened since the time of the case, since the DHP hearing. My inclination is to say nothing, even though what respondent's attorney has told you is not true. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter be taken under submission.